May it please the court, my name is Randall Weiner, counsel for Vanessa Murphy. My bar number is 23871. Vanessa Murphy was mauled in a PetSmart complex by a Belgian Malinois, similar to a German Shepherd, 5 aisles down from the Banfield store where Dr. Land, a veterinarian who owned Vinny, worked. Dr. Land's husband, Richard Bolander, was actually walking the dog around the PetSmart complex, something he had done a variety of times on that particular day. The issues before you are statute of limitations, as well as the duty and respondeat superior for Banfield. Statute of limitations argument deals with a claim that was brought against the dog trainer. There were arguments in the trial court that the dog was trained by Roger Andreasen to be in public without a muzzle, even though it had bitten before, savagely. And the trial court, Judge Mullins, ruled that the statute of limitations with respect to the dog trainer accrued on the same day that my client, Vanessa Murphy, was bitten.
I think he said began to accrue.
He did.
Which is a strange phrase.
It was a strange phrase in this context because we know from the First Interstate, the Piper case, as well as the Rusalka case, that the statute of limitations is always a fixed, the accrual date for a statute of limitations is always a fixed point in time. So that is one problem, but let's give him the benefit of the doubt. Let's assume that by began to accrue, he meant accrue. What that tells us is that he, and he's stepping in the shoes of the jury because we know that only in the clearest of circumstances from Maestro v. Brody or Maestro v. Brody should a judge determine the accrual date for a statute of limitations.
What's the legal principle upon which the accrual date should depend in this case?
I missed the first part of that.
What's the legal principle upon which the accrual date should be determined in this case? Should it be a reasonable time upon which to inquire about whether or not they're trainers? Should it be when later on, 2-3 years later, when a person becomes aware of there was a dog trainer and the dog trainer's name? What is the principle that would say, well, the time accrues against the dog trainer when what?
When a plaintiff reasonably knew, under the discovery rule, of the injury and its cause. And that's a determination for the jury.
Well, where's the limit of that argument then, Mr. Weiner? Where's the limit of your argument? I mean, I'll tell you frankly, I have concerns with your argument. If your clients, 10 years from now, they come forward and say, we never knew this dog was trained. Can they sue 10 years from now, assuming no statute of repose? Because it seems to me in your analysis, it would always be a fact question as to whether that was reasonable diligence for them to have learned 10 years from now, 20 years from now. It seems like there's no limit to your argument.
Well, two things. One, we don't have that in this case.
We've got to figure out the principle is, and I recognize maybe that's not, but I mean, I suppose your colleagues here would say that is the problem in this case. We're talking 3.5 years beyond the statute. I just called it 10. That we have to adopt, whatever we rule on here, we could feasibly adopt a rule, so I think we need to know the answer to this question. What's the limit?
Well, a wise jurist in the last line of the Salka dissent said that even where there's an abuse of the statute, there shouldn't be a strained interpretation of it. And the meaning is that the statute of limitations is critically important, as we know, for a plaintiff's ability to sue or not to sue. And so we leave up to the jury to decide what is reasonable.
Would there be any case where summary judgment would be proper on the accrual, where there's an issue of accrual?
In the clearest of facts.
Give me those facts.
Well, there was the Trigg case as well as the Salka case where the plaintiff knew at the time of the accident that the defendant did not have uninsured or underinsured motorist coverage. And the court ruled that he had actual knowledge at that point and he needed to bring his suit within 2 years against that UIM carrier, which was against the standard notion. You know, you normally have 3 plus 2, but the court said no, based on our reading of the statute, we're going to say that the two statutes ran concurrently because he had actual knowledge. In our case, there was no actual knowledge that there was a trainer involved when she was bitten. Maybe we look for constructive knowledge. And then is it reasonable to think that the day you're bitten, you know that the reason for your getting bitten was because the dog was trained poorly? Let me just finish one more thing. I think that my client is entitled to a little bit of time to recover from her wounds. These were serious. Bit of brass, she's still in PTSD. She's entitled to some time to recover. She's entitled to time to determine whether or not the dog had a trainer, whether that trainer trained the dog improperly, and whether there's causation there. How much time is reasonable or unreasonable? In our case, it was 11 months.
Well, let me ask you a couple questions now,
yes.
Counsel.
Yes.
First of all, is you're not saying as a matter of law, the statute of limitations had not expired. You're saying it's a question of fact for the jury.
That's correct, Judge.
Second question I have for you, Counsel, is doesn't this perhaps lead to some rather anomalous results? The idea that, well, you have to know the nature and the cause of the injury. Well, it's very clear that the nature and cause of the injury with respect to the, I guess, Bollinger's, were they the owners?
That's correct.
Right.
Bollinger and Lane.
That's very clear on day one. Now, somehow, there's a different statute of limitations for someone more attenuated to the actual injury. Doesn't that seem a little anomalous that you can have different statute of limitations based on, well, it's different cause, now nature of the cause. And the further, the more attenuated person can be more exposed for a longer period of time?
That's right. I believe that based on the discovery rule, the only rational way to read it is to say that you have two different statutes of limitations for different defendants based upon when you know they exist.
Oops. Sir, mm-hmm. Go ahead, finish your sentence. Excuse me.
No.
I was going to follow up on the point you just
yes.
made and ask you to respond to the language in two cases that I think is maybe responsive to what you're saying. In Jones, our Supreme Court said the statute of limitations begins to run when the claimant has knowledge of facts which would put a reasonable person on notice of the nature and extent of an injury, and that the injury was caused by the wrongful conduct of another. Your argument seems to be you have to have actual knowledge of the trainer. I think some pretty important language may suggest otherwise. Another one I want you to respond to, and then I'll shut up and listen to you. In the Crosby case from the division of this court, the division said, the point of accrual requires knowledge of the facts essential to the cause of action, not knowledge of the legal theory supporting the cause of action. And I'll tell you, goodness knows I'm wrong plenty. It's always been my understanding, and I want you to push back and respond, that you didn't have to know the actual person who caused it if you knew there was wrongful conduct, because that sets in motion your duty to investigate. Could you respond to that?
Of course.
I think I'm dead wrong, and that's okay.
Well, in this case, we had both. So it's a slam dunk. She didn't know that there was a trainer, that there was a tort action against the trainer, or the name of the trainer. As soon as the trainer's name was found out in discovery, a complaint was filed. He was added as a defendant 15 days later. Okay? So I interpret to mean you have to know who the other is, not just that maybe speculatively you may have been hurt in some other fashion. Remember, the discovery rule refers to knowledge, and maybe that's the place where we all begin, 1381-08.
Or knew or should have known is what it says.
Knew or should have known the facts you should have had knowledge of the facts. I'm sure there were knowledge in there. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I'm not quoting it properly right now. But it's about knowledge. And whether it's knowledge that there was a trainer in general or this particular trainer, the important thing is she gets a little time to investigate. And how much time? You can't say, I can't say, the trial court can't say. Because we know that is a question for the jury.
Well, let me suggest to you a different alternative. You get 2 years. I mean, you get from the date we knew, and I don't minimize at all. I hope this is clear. The extent of your client's injuries, what happened is horrible. It would be horrible for anybody. That's not the point. Certainly on the day of the bite, your client knew I was hurt and believed there was wrongful conduct of somebody here, and doesn't that set in motion? You got 2 years then to figure out who that somebody is to bring a lawsuit.
That's not what our discovery rule says. What you're referring to is the notice, the inquiry notice. You're put on notice to begin to inquire. But once that inquiry notice period has ended, then you have the statute of limitations to find a lawyer, to decide whether you want to put yourself through the legal process. There's a difference, and I think maybe the trial judge had this confusion as well. There's a difference between inquiry notice and the notice of accrual, which commences the statute of limitations.
But how is that distinguishable from the thing, the language in Jones that I read to you, which just says you had to know that the injury was caused by the wrongful conduct of another, or the language in Crosby, where you had to know the facts essential to the cause, not the legal theory. You knew all the facts. None of the facts really changed.
She didn't know the facts. Maybe that's the biggest dispute. She didn't know there was a dog trainer. She didn't know the dog was improperly trained. There's a distinction between knowing the dog is vicious and knowing that the dog was trained poorly. That's pure speculation. Now, are we going to set in motion a requirement, a theory that if you can speculate that there is an other out there, then the statute of limitations begins? No, I don't think it's speculation. I think it's knowledge.
Counsel, can I ask you to address the issue of Banfield's duty? Because I think that's the basis of the other part of the appeal.
Yes, thank you, Judge. We think duty is predicated on three parts. First, the manual itself said, hey, employees of PetSmart, leave your dogs at home. But secondly, there's something I can't stress enough. We had a dishonest defendant in this case. We had a defendant who lied about whether this dog had bitten before. She wanted to save her dog, but it had, and it's in the record, that dog had savagely bitten a furniture mover who had scars on her face until the day she died because of this dog that bit 1 year before it bit my client. This is not a client who was honest. Throughout the deposition, she lied not only about the prior dog bite, she lied about, you know, she did her best to cover for Banfield and to cover for Mr. Andreas. Under such circumstances, I contend it's up to the jury to decide whether or not Dr. Land affirmatively brought the dog to work. There are a lot of facts out there which suggest that she affirmatively brought the dog to work. It was brought there numerous times to go into the Banfield, to walk up around the PetSmart complex. The dog was then trained to be a service dog for this veterinarian. It was the chief veterinarian for this particular Banfield office. Why am I bringing this up? Because if Dr. Land affirmatively brought the dog to work or said, honey, you know, bring the dog to work, or honey, I know the dog is coming in today, you know, have a nice walk. If she put people at risk, then there's an affirmative duty to protect the public. And thirdly, there was a corporate culture at this particular Banfield that allowed people to bring their dogs to work. What all this adds up to is that there was a duty, that there was actual action taken by Dr. Land to allow this dog, to encourage this dog. We think it should go before the jury because they can decide whether she's telling the truth or not. There was an affirmative duty on the part of Dr. Land to tell her husband, honey, leave the dog at home.
You said the dog was a service dog?
It was being trained to be a service dog for Dr. Land. That's correct.
She needs a service dog.
She has epilepsy. That's right.
And that would have been in the course and scope of her employment to have told her husband to leave the dog at home?
That, again, is a jury question. We know that the course of whether a course of conduct falls within an employer's responsibility is a question for the jury. And yes, we think a jury could determine that it fell within the course of conduct. Why? Again, it's being trained to be a service dog. The only reason that dog was there, as opposed to any other store in the state, was because she worked there. And she worked there late, and the husband brought the dog there and marched around the PetSmart, and then it bit my client 5 miles down from the front door of this Banfield, which is embedded within this PetSmart complex. I'm going to reserve my 30 seconds.
Well, actually, counsel, we're going to give you about 2 minutes and 30 seconds. We're going to add 2 minutes on to the rebuttal time, and at the least, you will have 17 minutes to split if you want, rather than just 15. How's that? So you'll have 2:33 when you come back, and you'll have 17 now.
May it please the court, I'm John Lifesack, and I represent A Caring Doctor, which does business as Banfield, and I'll use the name Banfield. We're the company that ran the veterinary hospital on separate premises where the co-owner of the dog was working at the time their husband brought the dog into Banfield. So before I begin, I wanted to reply to a couple things that were just raised. One is these issues on the duties of Banfield. Only one of those was ever argued in the brief. I can't say for sure that it was not argued to the trial court, but the issue of the manual and, you know, the rule that you can't use, employees are supposed to leave their dogs at home, that's in the opening brief. This issue about that there's something about Dr. Land that she lied somehow relates to the liability of Banfield, that was never argued. And the issue of a corporate culture, I don't see a clear line between that issue and the rule, but this issue of a corporate culture leading to some kind of liability, that was never a theory that was pursued at the trial court and in the opening brief. So I would submit that the court should not consider those arguments that are raised for the first time here on oral argument. The issue is whether or not the trial court properly granted summary judgment in favor of Banfield on the two claims. One is a negligence claim against Banfield, and the second is vicarious liability against Banfield. So the trial court analyzed the legal duty of Banfield from the standpoint of the traditional negligence, foreseeability, existence of the duty case law. In our brief, we have pointed out that there is a finer point that you can draw on these negligence duty cases. There's the cases that the trial court used, which are the classic misfeasance cases, where a defendant actively does something to increase or to create a risk of harm. And then there's cases which involve a non-feasance duty, which I submit is what this case did, which is there's a PetSmart store. PetSmart's open to the public, and PetSmart lets customers bring their dogs in. Now, this happened to be a PetSmart customer who is married to somebody who works in the vet hospital, which is on separate premises and, you know, separate entity. Now, from the standpoint of the person who is in control of the premises, the owner of the premises, which is PetSmart, it's perfectly okay to bring that dog in. If there's an issue about policies that should be relevant to this, the only relevant policies are what are PetSmart's policies on this. And PetSmart says it's okay. So there was a situation that was created when a customer brought a dog into the store. Banfield, off to the side, literally and figuratively, had nothing to do with creating that risk or increasing the risk. Banfield is the corporate employer of a vet who happens to own a dog. The dog was not there that day to get any kind of vet services or to get any kind of boarding services. The vet's husband was there to pick up his wife at the end of her day. Her work day, her job duties were going to be done at the time when she came out of the store, met her husband, and then was going to leave. So, as we've argued in the brief, this is a case of non-feasance, not a case of misfeasance. And I'm not saying that if you find this is a case of misfeasance that, you know, somehow we have a duty. No, that's not our argument. Our argument is that even if you follow the misfeasance cases, which is what Judge Mullins did, there is no duty. But if you really look at the branch of these negligence cases that talks about non-feasance, there is no duty. It's a much more restrictive area of negligence duty. And because Banfield had nothing to do with creating or increasing the risk, we think that those nonfeasance cases apply. Now, there are cases where a person who just sits passively by and doesn't do an affirmative act that causes that, where you do have a duty to come forward. None of those situations apply here. Those are cases where there's a special relationship. An innkeeper and a guest, an employer and an employee, a landowner. In this case, the only such relationship was between PetSmart, the landowner, and Ms. Murphy. But that's now subsumed under this premises liability, and that's not even part of this case. So perhaps, you know, there would be some kind of a special duty, special relationship there. There may be a special relationship between husband and wife, but that's between Dr. Lant and Mr. Bollinger. That's not between Ms. Murphy and anybody here. So there's no special relationships that would give rise to any kind of duty under tort because of nonfeasance. So because of that reason, we think that the trial court correctly granted summary judgment that there's no duty on the part of Danfield. The second claim that was in the complaint against Danfield was respondeat superior, that somehow we're vicariously liable for the acts of Dr. Lant. There's some overlap between the two claims. It's not clear who else other than Dr. Lant we're going to be held liable for. I mean, there's nobody else who's mentioned in any of these, in the facts of this case, other than Dr. Lant, whose liability we might have by imputation. So what did Dr. Lant do in the course of her job for Danfield that had anything to do with this accident? Nothing. This dog was not being treated. Now, I don't want to disregard the fact that the dog had been in the vet hospital before, and it had been there for some nail clipping and grooming, but that was not why the dog was there that day. Now, she happened to be a dog owner. She was a vet, but there's a separation between what her job duties are for Banfield and the fact that she owned a dog in her personal life. So she and her husband owned a dog, and what they did in that aspect has nothing to do with Banfield. There's nothing in the record about any connection between her ownership of the dog and her status as a vet for Banfield. If there was something where the dog was on the way or to or from, maybe it'd be slightly different. But this is simply a case where the husband was walking the dog through the store to give the dog some training, some exposure to the public, while he waited for his wife to get off work.
Let me ask you a question.
Yes.
I was waiting for you to take a breath.
Yeah.
So let's take Mr. Weiner's argument, at least as I understand it. Here, let's assume that Dr. Lant knew fully this dog was coming and was coming to pick her up and knew that the dog had bit somebody before and that the dog was possibly problematic. Assuming that there's evidence of that, and I would like to address what the evidence in the summary judgment record is, because we're hearing a lot of theoreticals.
We're starting off to some extent.
Yeah, I'd like to hear what that is. I think your argument is that may well get a pretty good negligence case and get you the jury in negligence against Dr. Lant, but it doesn't get you a vicarious liability claim because there's no connection.
That's exactly right, because if Dr. Lant knew something about that dog, it's because she owned the dog in her personal capacity. There's nothing in this case where she was a treating veterinarian and she was, let's just imagine, she was being treated for, or she was providing some input on what do we do about this dog that's hot. And maybe she gave some bad advice. Maybe that would be a different kind of a case where she would have some independent culpability in her professional capacity for Banfield. But that's not what the record here is.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, she just owned the dog. And whether or not she knew about this you know, the propensity of the dog, the fact is that that was strictly in her personal capacity and had nothing to do with the work that she was doing today.
Would it be any different, and I don't even know for sure if there was evidence of this, if other folks at Banfield knew that they were, that this dog had bitten somebody before and had some bad propensities, would that change the facts? Say everybody in Banfield knew this dog was problematic and Dr. Lant knew the dog was coming that day, would that change the facts?
I'm not going to say that there, you know, you can't imagine circumstances where it would change it, but we still have the problem that this happened outside the store, outside the Banfield Hospital, excuse me. It happened on PetSmart. So, you know, is it conceivable that if this was such a horrendous reputation of the dog and everybody in Banfield knew about it, that maybe they had a duty to do something? But again, you know, it's either the job duties of the people at Banfield. How far does it extend? So did they set in motion something that created this risk in the store? If somebody wants to bring, you know, a dog from home, that has nothing to do with Banfield. If Banfield was treating a vicious dog and knew that this was a risk and let the dog walk out without a muzzle, say, I mean, that's a different kind of a case. But this is a case where somebody just brought the dog in from home, had nothing to do with Banfield. So for all of these reasons, we think the trial court was correct in granting summary judgment.
Now, you're still talking about nonfeasance. You're not yet talking about respondeat superior.
I thought I was, but if I...
Well, that's what I just want to be clear.
What I was talking about was situations where Banfield could be vicariously liable for something that Dr. Lennon did. So...
Or failed to do.
So there could be a situation where if she had a special relationship, or Banfield had a special relationship, you know, maybe that would be a case where there would be a duty that she would have. But that's
hence Banfield.
Well, the problem with that is that none of that relates to her job duties.
That's what I'm trying to find out.
She could have theoretically some nonfeasance duty as a veterinarian.
Counsel, you're about 5.5 minutes.
Do I have 30 seconds left?
Go ahead.
Okay. If she was treating and in her job duties, that could create nonfeasance duties, but not this one, not this case where this had nothing to do with the treatment. So unless you have any other questions, I'll sit down.
Thank you. Please hold the timer until other counsel has a chance to get up here.
Thank you, Your
Honor. All right, please start.
Sure, Your Honor. Again, my name is Mike Frazier, registration number 23189. I represent Mr. Andreessen and the Colorado Dog Academy. And again, the issue for my clients is the statute of limitations one. But what I hope to discuss is the distinction between injuries, cause, and liability, and how those distinctions affect the accrual date of the statute of limitations. The statute 13-8108, subsection 1, says the action accrues on both the day of the injury and its cause should have been known. It talks about the injury and the cause. Those are the two elements. It doesn't talk about the parties or the liability.
And when you're talking about cause here, are you including in the broad spectrum of that term the possible negligence of the dog trainer?
No, Your Honor. In this case, the cause of the injury was the dog bite. The injuries were the bites from the dog.
So you're not talking about responsibility. You're just talking about causation from an event of the dog bite.
That's correct. The event is, now I believe that's what's talked about in the case in the briefs, is the event, the time I reasonably should have known I have a claim against someone. And I think the case law is clear that the distinction thereafter is you have 2 years after the date you know you've been injured and you have a claim against someone to find out who that person is and why they may be liable.
Okay, let me give you a hypothetical.
Yes, sir.
You're driving down the road, somebody runs a stoplight, T-bones you and destroys your car and injures you. And you know that who the driver was, but what you don't know and don't find out for some time is that there was defective brakes and there were a manufacturing problem, a product liability problem for Ford Motor Company. You don't find that out until after the 6 years runs on a negligence claim. Have you lost Ford Motor Company?
Yes. The reason you lost Ford Motor Company is you knew on that day you had some injuries. You knew on that day you were hit by a car. A car was involved in that accident.
It was a Ford, by the way.
It wasn't a Chevy, you have to be careful. But it was a Ford, and the Ford hit you, and somebody was driving it, just like maybe the person that was driving it drank too many beers. There's a dram shop act claim against someone else. And maybe there's a problem with the tire. You have 2 years, according to the case law we cited, to find out what was wrong with that car, the driver, somebody who served that driver, the person who owned the car. All those different parties, find out who they are and try and locate during that time and establish a prima facie case of liability against them. And the statute also says, if I'm not sure and I'm running out of time, I know there may be a problem, I can name John Toes, I can name other people and attempt to relate it back, and there's some relief there.
So your position is there's one statute of limitation, not several, depending upon if you could break down the causes.
That's correct, Your Honor. I think the reason is the plaintiff has confused the identity of the party, which is a lot, which is the courts have said in Leverado, I think the Brand EMD, says the plaintiff is responsible for determining who is liable for her injury and doing so before the statute of limitations expires.
Isn't potential malpractice of the veterinarian or of the dog trainer, I'm sorry, a cause?
The potential malpractice of the dog trainer, no, I don't believe there's a duty of care owed. I don't, for the same reasons mentioned by Coquels.
I understand that. Okay. I understand that. But it is, the malpractice of the dog trainer is a cause.
Yes. I mean, theoretically, it could be.
Okay.
And so what do we know then? We know I got bit by a dog, can't sue the dog. Somebody is responsible for how that dog acts, or at least I think they are. I don't think it was me. I think it's someone. So then I have the statute puts an affirmative duty on you to inquire into who is that person. Is it somebody who didn't feed the dog that morning? Is it the owner? Is it somebody inside the building? Is it a dog trainer? You have to ask those questions. Those questions were not asked until after the statute ran by the plaintiff's own attorney. I don't think it's disputed 9 months later. Who trained your dog?
So your argument, as I understand it, Mr. Frazier, really says two different, when we talk about cause, we're talking about two different things. And I suppose you're talking about, I can't remember which one would be legal cause and factual cause, but what you're saying is you knew, at least factually, what happened and what it precipitated you were hurt. A dog attacked this woman. But it's the duty then within the statute of time to go figure out who was liable.
Right.
And so cause means something different. Am I really understanding you correctly?
That's correct. I believe the statute says, what were my injuries, just some of my knowing to do it, and what event, what happened to cause it? Then I have 2 years to find out who did it and why they made it.
And here's my concern with your argument, and I recognize your time's up, but I appreciate an answer to this question. You say, you just phrased the statute as, yeah, I know an event happened. You change the words of the statute. It says, all the case law, I think, seems to say, you have to know of your injury and the cause. And you kind of add some words to what the case law says. And I guess I'm not quite sure what you rely on for that. Where is moving the vision of the cause?
Well, I guess I don't know that a statute, a case specifically called it that specific event, although they've reverted to it. But if you have to draw a line between causation and liability, we know, and the courts have said, we can draw that line with regard to identifying the parties, and they've said it over and over again, and that's the entire point of their case is, I don't know who it was.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Judge. 33 seconds won't be difficult.
We've seen people try.
I can imagine. So opposing counsel's view of the discovery rule just isn't the case law. The case law says you're entitled to know the facts surrounding the cause. That would be why you were hurt. That would be who hurt you. In this case, we had neither.
Do you have a best case on that? You know what you just said, entitled to know who hurt you, why you were hurt. What's the best case that supports that?
I list a series of cases on page 14 of my brief.
Thank you.
And once again, I refer you to 13.8108, which says knowledge of the cause. doesn't say speculation that maybe this dog was trained. It's knowledge of the cause. We did raise this issue in our briefs. I want to address that very quickly. The notion of a corporate culture that Banfield let folks bring their dogs to work in violation of corporate policy frequently, according to Dr. Lant, that's found on page 22 of our brief.
I think the question is whether it was raised in the trial court and argued in the trial court.
On summary judgment, in the summary judgment briefs? I have to read them. I thought the issue was that I can't raise it.
No, the issue is you can't raise it on appeal. It wasn't raised in the trial court, as I recall the argument.
Right. Well, there was, yes.
I think he was arguing you're raising it only in an argument. But the question also remains whether it was raised in the trial court.
See, I thought he said, since I didn't raise it in these particular briefs, I couldn't raise it now. I don't think that's the law. I thought that's what he was saying. Misfeasance versus malfeasance, the whole notion of duty, I'd like to address that. Even a defendant or appellee agrees that you would have a duty if there was nonfeasance, if there was a special relationship between the individuals, and there was it. We had a husband and a wife, and you'll find in Restatement Second of Torts, Section 314, Comment C, that it refers to a special relationship. So even
but it has to be with your client, not the husband and the wife. Your client wasn't married to one of these people. I don't understand your argument.
Okay. That's not my understanding. It's a special relationship between. Okay. Let me fall back on whether it's nonfeasance versus malfeasance. It's a tough line to draw in this case, whether there was malfeasance or nonfeasance. Did Dr. Lant say affirmatively, bring my dog to work, honey? Is that malfeasance or misfeasance? If she said, leave the dog at home, honey, is that malfeasance or misfeasance? I think in this case, we have the right to go to a jury and have the jury to decide, hey, what are the facts in this circumstance?
Okay, counsel. I'm sorry, your time has expired.
I appreciate the extra time.
Case will stand submitted and opinion will issue in due course.